today on Ag News Daily.
And they were farmers in Bavaria, and so when they came here, they were farmers. And to this day, the Ring family is farmers.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Mike Pearson here, coming to you from downtown Chicago, joined, as always, on the podcast today by Delaney Howell. Delaney, you're rocking a sweatshirt today. Living life on the edge. Why?
Because Iowa Public Television Station is freezing inside, and then I get outside to cut the podcast in my car so that I can have, you know, quiet, peace and quiet, and there's not good service in there, and my car is extremely hot, so I'm going to be muting my mic in between discussion here so I can crank my AC back up.
Good. Put that mic on mute. Madison Honkamp, you're the one we want to talk to anyway. What are you up to today?
Mike, I've just been getting stuff ready for newsletters, and quick plug, I'm hoping to get our kind of weekly newsletter going, so if any listeners would like to get that, check out our website and subscribe and join the network, and I think there's even a little bar that they can now sign up for the newsletter. Is that right, Delaney?
Yes, there's a subscribe button at the bottom of our website, globalagnetwork.com, or you can always just create a profile, which allows you to stay in tune with your favorite podcasts and blogs.
Yes.
Fantastic. Great work, Madison. We appreciate that.
But I also have a quick little plug, another little plug, because my dad works for Heartland Co-op, and they had a dinner last night with a bunch of different people. I'm not quite sure what company or what it was for. But he said there were people from Canada, the Netherlands, Australia, China, I think he said Japan, and a couple other places, and they all knew what Ag News Daily was.
Well, what? That is very cool.
That yeah. is awesome. I love it.
But of course, we love you.
And of course, he said he had to brag because his favorite child was on the podcast. So, I mean, I would like to say that that's what he said, but
I'm sure it was.
Yeah, probably.
Well, favorite child, why don't you tell us what news you've got jumping out at you today?
Well, one big thing that I saw today was going back to the Trump administration and with the whole immigration ordeal that we have going on right now, as well as SNAP. And so from October 1st to July 29th, the State Department has rejected about 5,343 immigrant visa applications. And I know we talked about probably about a month ago or so that we were trying to work with, I believe, Guatemala to kind of for migrant workers and to get visas visa applications approved earlier and faster, and so that they were really able to legally come into this country. But that doesn't seem to be the case right now. And it was just crazy to me about how many people haven't been able to be approved for applications in just a short amount of time. And a big thing that this article kind of touched on was how they had included the participation in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program kind of as a factor into either approving the application or not.
Okay. All right. Well, keep an eye on it. We appreciate your diligent research and dogged reporting on this.
Well, and it was just interesting to see that they brought SNAP into kind of the application process rather than having it be after they became citizens or
right
had
right.
Visa.
Rolling it out there first rather than waiting around.
It was a little confusing, so maybe we'll find some more clarity on that coming up in the following weeks. But
all right, Well, I've got some other news from south of the border, and that is coming out of Mexico. Madison, you talked about this earlier, but the top Mexican trade negotiator earlier today slammed a proposal to inspect all Mexican tomatoes at the border, saying it was, quote, totally unacceptable, and that doing so would trigger a logistical collapse in cross-border trade. So this comes back to the battle that has been going on for the past couple of years. In May, the U.S. imposed a 17.5% tariff on Mexican tomatoes because both U.S. and Mexico were working together to find an agreement that would basically stop an anti-dumping investigation into Mexican tomatoes, and that deal never happened, so the U.S. just went ahead and put a 17.5% tariff on. Well, basically they're saying that we want this tariff removed, and the U.S. is saying, okay, but we're going to inspect every tomato that crosses the border, and the Mexican trade delegation is balking, and you know, this could have broader impacts as we look at USMCA's passage moving forward.
Yes, that will definitely impact USMCA moving forward, Mike. And I'm going to bring some news here back from the United States, since we do have a good chunk of our listeners coming from the U.S. And really, this is going to impact the global market as well. In the latest Ag Economy Barometer, corn and soybean producers were both surveyed, asking how many folks took Prevent Plant, what their expectations for this crop year were. And the survey found that 1 in 4 corn and soybean growers said that they've filed Prevent Planting benefits. And of those farmers who filed Prevent Plant claims, 61% said they couldn't plant at least 15% of their intended corn acreage. And 42% said they didn't plant at least 25% of their intended corn acreage. So it's going to be interesting here to see this August 12th report come out next Monday. Mike, I think it's going to be interesting for you, too, now that you're in the heart of Chicago, what's going to happen there. I know they don't trade necessarily on the floor anymore, but just maybe a different vibe than what we feel here in Des Moines or in the Midwest.
Right, right. And there's just so much uncertainty. When I talk to the brokers both at our office and just here in downtown Chicago, nobody knows really what the USDA is planning. And we got maybe a bit of an indication, both with that survey, Delaney, that backs up the claim that, you know, acres might come down quite a bit. And then we also got this one from Farm Futures. Earlier today, they released their survey, and they said that their survey shows 83 million acres of corn and 80 million acres of beans. That bean number is right in line with what USDA proposed back in June. But that 83 million acres of corn, that's about 7 million acres fewer than what USDA proposed. They've never cut that many acres over the summer out of production. So this resurvey is going to be a huge deal, you know, one way or the other. Either it's going to show a mid-80 million corn acres, and, you know, that's going to be bullish, obviously, or it won't, and the expectations won't be met, and we could see this corn market just sell off to beat the dickens afterwards. So it is definitely going to be a challenging situation for sure.
That it is. And one thing that's really held steady, even though the economy, the farm economy, continues to be in this slump, Mike, do you have any guesses on that?
One thing, what now, Delaney?
That's held steady amid all of this influx in farm economy.
Farmland prices, Delaney Howell.
Mike Pearson, you are right on the money today.
Always. Always, buddy. It's how I roll.
Well,
I'm on the money because I ain't got no money.
That's true. There you go. Farm estate values have climbed about $60 per acre on average in 2019 to about $3,100 on average per acre, which is a 1.9% increase from last year, according to the USDA. They published a report on Tuesday stating these facts, and they also said that croplands on average are up 1.2%, pasture values increased about 2.2%, and this continues a years-long trend towards higher farmland prices.
Yes, indeed. The rebound from the sell-off in 2013 continues, that's for sure.
That it does.
Well, Madison, what other news do you have for us today?
One last thing I saw today was, and obviously we've been talking about this a lot, but just kind of the strength or the progressing kind of trade feud almost with China. That's how this article states it. And I think Trump is really, I think he tweeted, was it yesterday? I think we talked about it. He tweeted about wanting to help farmers and how there was kind of a little bit of backlash from that. But we might even see some more trade aid coming through either next year or even the year after that.
Yep, I think that's going to be the case as long as this thing is in position. I've got to imagine, you know, we're going to see money rolling out of D.C. coming to the heartland.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it will be a pretty big topic, especially with the election year.
Yes. Yes, it certainly will. MFP will definitely be in the headlines. I just have one other just kind of an update because we won't get to it in the market segment. But we had a crazy day, or a crazy morning, I should say, in the markets. We had a huge sell-off in the stock market and a huge rally in the bond market and in gold. 30-year Treasury rallies just the 30-year Treasury the 10-year Treasury fell to the lowest level since October, and gold went to a 6-year high earlier today. There was some definite money moving around Madison in a large part because of these trade fears and what it might do to the broader economy.
Yeah, I definitely think these trade talks have – the economy's taken a hit from it, honestly.
Yeah, it is, and the concern is it could get worse. But, Delaney, do you have any other news for us?
I don't have any other news.
Fantastic. Let's roll right into the market segment. Folks, our markets are brought to us by our friends at Zahner, and I'm very excited to announce that tomorrow at 3:30, the Zahner Group will be doing a webinar. I'm very excited to be the moderator. Hop on to the Ag News Daily Facebook page, and you can catch a link right there and go get registered. You'll be hearing from Ted Seifert, Brian Grossman, and Dan Hussey, all talking about what to expect on August 12th from the USDA. Or you can always give us a shout at the office. You can reach me directly at 312-277-0112 or visit us on the web at Zahner, Zahner.com, and make sure you mention you heard it on Ag News Daily. Looking at the markets today, we had an interesting day, as I mentioned, but corn, beans, and wheat all finished in the green. September corn was up 2.5 cents at 406.5, with the December contract up 1.5, finishing the day at 414 even. In soybeans, that SEP contract was up a penny at 854 even, with the November also up a penny, wrapping the day at 866.75. In Chicago wheat, September was up 4.25 at 488.25. December up 3.5 cents, finishing at 491.25. And we caught a bid today in the live cattle. August live cattle up 47.5 cents at 107.60, with the October up 22.5, finishing at 106.45. Mixed trade in feeder cattle today with the September contract down 7.5 cents at 139.37.50. The October was up 25, finishing at 138.90. And in lean hogs, the August was up 60 cents, finished at 77.72.5, with the October up $2.25, closing the day at 66.85. And a little bit of weakness today in the Class 3 milk futures. That August contract was down 7 cents at 17.50, with the September down 9, finishing up at 1781. Delaney, why don't you tell us who we're talking to for our interview here on this Wednesday?
Well, we are talking, I chatted with Dr. Rick Batty, who works for Rank Seed. It's a smaller, private, independent seed company up in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. So he's going to share with us really the experience he's seen here in the corn industry, specifically over the last 40-plus years.
Well, I'm excited to be joined by the corn product manager and new business development man, Dr. Rick Batty, who works for Rank Seeds out of Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. Rick, first of all, thank you for joining me, but I want to talk a little bit about your background in the traits and the agronomy industry before we get to your work here with Rank Seed. Tell me a little bit about your background, because you have a really interesting one.
Oh, boy, I tell you what, I've been in the business for 41 years now. I got my PhD at Wisconsin in breeding and genetics, and then I became a corn breeder for DeKalb Pfizer Genetics. And so I was a corn breeder there from 1978 until 1980. and until 1990, I'm sorry, until 1990, and developed products that were adapted to the Northern Corn Belt. And what's really interesting is to look back and see the difference between what's happening now in breeding nurseries compared to what I was doing back at that time. You know, when I was in graduate school, we could not get the corn plants to regenerate themselves from single cells. In other words, we found a way to create the callus tissue, the undifferentiated cells that are just kind of a mass that would kind of grow and not differentiate into various parts of the corn plant. Until then, after that, somebody was able to take this undifferentiated cell mass and get individual cells to regenerate and grow into corn plants. That started something absolutely fantastic, because then we knew it could go into transformation and start incorporating genes from other plants and other species. But my career as a breeder was pretty much the same conventional method that had been used for thousands and thousands of years in making corn what it is today. Selection and regeneration and propagation and developing the hybrid from it. And so that stayed there as the concept and the main way that breeders developed new hybrids for the next 30 years. And so it's been fun to kind of follow this just in the most recent times of where breeding has changed, and it's got a whole different, more efficient way of developing new hybrids. But as we went through the process in 1990, things started to get more in terms of how we learned about the genomics and what genes were actually doing on an individual molecular basis. And so then we could start to figure out that, hey, maybe we can start manipulating things and start getting more efficient in how we would bring products through the system. But at that time, then, I became part of management and breeding and didn't actually get involved in the breeding anymore. I was part of the management of several breeders, and then from there became an owner of a company, and then from there into the larger organizations, and then from there back to a smaller company again that is at Rink Seed. So I've seen just a tremendous amount of fun changes in how products are developed and evaluated.
And so Rink Seed is an independent seed company, which is really unique in today's day and age. Tell me about the differences of owning your own company, working for some of the big players in the seed industry, and now working for an independent company.
Okay, when I first started, I was with a small company, and that became DeKalb Pfizer. And then from there, I went back to a smaller company again and was a breeder and an organizer of research there with Supercross Seeds. That then became part of Garst Seed Company, and I was supervising several breeders in the Garst Seed Company business. And then from there, I went back to a smaller company, Midwest Seed Genetics, and became an owner of Midwest Seed Genetics, and being one of the executives there that was helping to be responsible for the humongous growth of Midwest and then on into Channel. Having the opportunity to get into the Monsanto system by them purchasing Channel, we were able to increase our sales simply by hiring more people and getting a larger footprint. And then after that, went back to a smaller company at Rink Seed. It's a totally different atmosphere of being able to have independence with regard to the selection of products. With a larger company, you're kind of locked into using products that are only coming through the research pipeline of that particular system. because licensing is expensive. And if you have to pay for your research organization plus licensing it from someplace else, that gets very expensive. What's nice about Rink Seed is, well, we do have some small breeding projects going on here. Most of our product is licensed in, and we can choose from any of the sources out there, and gives us more diversity with regard to what we advance for our growers. It gives us an opportunity to have an array of products with different genetic backgrounds, different technology traits, and basically different sources of information with regard to those products.
And Rick, I guess I should take a step back here for those folks listening, because we have listeners from all over the U.S., and some of them may not have heard of Rank Seed. Can you tell us about some of the history of the company and the territory that you guys cover?
Oh, sure. It's really a fun thing, because the Rink family immigrated from Bavaria in Germany in 1846 and settled into this area of Wisconsin. And they were farmers in Bavaria, and so when they came here, they were farmers. And to this day, the Rink family is farmers. They are a group of people that know what farming is, because it's in their DNA almost that it's come this far in so many years. And even as a seed company, because they focus all their efforts now on seed business, they're farmers and they understand farmers. A few years ago, I would say 10 years ago, they were primarily known as an early season company. In other words, providing hybrid seed and soybeans for Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, and a little bit into the Dakotas. Now we've got expanded our efforts into Nebraska, Kansas, Iowa, Illinois, and we've got a larger footprint than we've ever had before. So it's a bigger following, and it's really enlarged the business that we cover.
And as you continue to enlarge the business, that changes what you're doing from a genetic standpoint. How are you making sure that the traits and the genetics that you're introducing are effective in that wide variety of territory?
So part of it is we have very good suppliers of our product that we license from. We get several of our products out of the Monsanto pipeline, now known as the Bayer Research Pipeline. But we also get products from other sources, which gives us a great amount of diversity that helps us with regard to genetic vulnerabilities that are out there. But what's kind of nice is that it being independent, we can pick and choose. And what we do is that we bring many, many products into our testing system and evaluate all the products altogether from all the different sources. That way, then, the cream rises to the top, and it gives us the opportunity to pick and choose which products we choose to go forward with. Being a smaller company, we can focus on products that maybe the larger companies don't want to deal with. The larger companies tend to choose products that work over a larger area. Mm-hmm. We can focus in on, say, we need a new product for Illinois. Or we need a new product that is geared toward being adapted in Nebraska, and so we can pick those things out and evaluate them, and then those that are good enough to get a Rink commercial product name, they will rise to the top, and we produce them.
So working in this industry for 41 years, you've seen a lot of different growing seasons. Have you ever seen one like this one that we're seeing in 2019? And how do you How do you adapt to that?
Well, I tell you, it's been a tough year, not just for Rink Seed and those of us who deliver the seed out there, but the farmers. I've never seen this wide of an effect on farmers. You know, we've had situations where there were challenges in the past. Too much water, too little water, too much rain, too much hail. But those were in various regions. Not necessarily so widespread as what the excessive amount of moisture that we had this year. And it just kept happening. Every couple of days, there'd be more and more rain that the farmers would end up dealing with. And they'd just get the soil ready to go out and plant it, and it would rain again. And it was just so sad to watch this. We had to adapt as a company because the later in the season it got, the more farmers started to think about, okay, I bought this particular relative maturity product. I'm going to have to switch to an earlier product. Well, what that ended up doing then, because it's so widespread, we had to start with the earlier products up north and pull them down, and just it would be a trickle-down effect. So we were moving product around just tremendously more than what we ever would in a single season. It was a tough year, and it's hurt everybody.
And I think the thing that a lot of people are waiting and watching for is really to see how this crop progresses, how it comes out of the field when harvest time comes. We know the genetics are there for drought resistance.
Right.
Are the genetics there for the extremely wet start to the growing season that we had?
That's a tough one. You know, each generation of improvement that breeders go through, the germplasm increases in its tolerance because we just develop products based on their performance in various conditions. And so we've had an opportunity to develop products, like you say, for drought tolerance and for heat tolerance and some diseases that have come through. But, you know, there's never really been a lot of products that have come through extreme wet conditions like we've had this year. That unfortunately, when a corn plant grows in wet conditions, it usually means a very shallow root system because it hasn't had to stretch the root system down to get moisture or nutrients. So I'm concerned now that the root system is so shallow that severe winds that would come through, there's going to create a lot of root lodging. The other thing that a lot of moisture early does, it creates a perfect environment for disease to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And we're already seeing gray leaf spot, northern leaf spot, some gosses coming in the west. We're seeing anthracnose come in. And I worry about a couple of things here, that the disease is starting to creep in to the corn plants, but they are earlier in the maturity than what that disease normally hits it. And so that's going to affect yield because it will start to take away leaf area that is feeding that plant and helping it produce grain. The other thing that I'm concerned about is that we have had so much moisture throughout the early part of the growing season that a lot of the nitrogen has leached away. So while the corn plant may look really, really good now and green and just lush and pretty much unaffected by the environment, when it gets to the point of where it really needs nitrogen to finish the grain off and produce a lot of that grain and stay alive through the whole process, I'm afraid that it's going to run out of nitrogen. And we're going to start to see that by seeing the brown areas on each side of the leaf margin. And it will start at the bottom of the plant, and it will work its way up. And eventually, once it gets to the leaves that are above the ear, then that's attacking the point that's really going to be critical in finishing that corn off.
Well, it's going to be an interesting year. I won't ask you to speculate what you think we're going to get for a final yield, because I don't think anybody knows at this point.
No, they don't.
But when you look at the future of what the industry holds from rank seed perspective, just from what you've seen over your past 41 years here, what do you think are the next things coming down the pipeline as far as seed genetics or traits or otherwise come?
So the pipeline of traits in the three major trait companies is pretty full. And they're spending a lot of money, millions of dollars every day, to develop new traits, new sources of new herbicide resistance, new sources of disease and insect resistance. What I think has made things probably progress more rapidly than anybody would have ever thought is the knowledge about the molecular aspect of the genetics. Being able to know exactly what a gene does and how it's made up and where it is in that plant. Knowing that there are some genes that are particularly active in increasing the performance of the plant, and then identifying where it is, and then using that information to create a better situation in the next generation, selecting for that region of the corn plant. And it's gone from the breeders being more of an artist than a scientist to you're now more of a scientist than you are an artist. Because for so many years through my early career, you were selecting based on what you saw and what the combine harvested, and you tried to correlate the two while you were selecting products early in the generation. Well, now you can take leaf tissue samples or pieces of the kernel off and do a genetic analysis and know right away whether or not that particular plant has the right genes that are going to be either all favorable or not enough favorable, or, you know, we're going to have to throw that one away. So therefore, they can screen literally millions of seeds in a year to get to the right ones that are going to have the right genetic combinations.
It's going to be an exciting time for agriculture.
I think
so. Sounds like it. Well, Dr. Rick Batty from Rank Seed, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Again, a big thank you to Dr. Rick Batty. In full disclosure, guys, I was attending their annual seed meeting and had the chance to talk to him over the weekend, but really interesting stuff.
Very cool, Delaney. It's great that you had the chance to get out there and get around and meet some interesting people. It's the funnest part of this job.
That it is.
Well, I tell you what, another fun thing is going back over past episodes of Ag News Daily. Madison, where can listeners go to do that if they're really looking for a rip-roaring good time?
Well, Mike, listeners can always find us at our website at globalagnetwork.com/agnewsdaily. They can also find lots of other, not only podcasts, but also articles, blogs, and some videos from other providers, actually. And if they want to chat with us, not through the podcast, but rather through social media, they can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Ag News Daily and at Global Ag Network.
Fantastic. Delaney, with that, should we let the people go?
Let's let them go.